It's time now to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr., family medicine physician Dr. George J. Patruncio, and well-known philanthropist Cal Rudman team up to bring you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. This could be the most important radio show you'll ever listen to. Now, here are Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr., Dr. George Patruncio, and Cal Rudman on Inside Medicine.
Welcome, everybody. The Philadelphia Marketplace is ready for Inside Medicine. We have a fantastic guest on top tap for today. It's going to be Dr. Matt Olivo, a dermatologist suprema, who has an expertise for looking for beauty as he does some cosmetic work also. He will be here, and we are going to hear some great information. Additionally, there is some hope for everybody on Saturday mornings. There was a recent publication on eggs, and believe it or not, they got a reprieve, because basically egg consumption, according to the American Journal of Medicine, generates an overall decrease in cardiovascular events. So the analysis suggested that higher consumption of eggs, more than one egg a day, was not associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, but was associated with a significant reduction in the risk of cardiovascular disease. So it looks like eggs are in. The most important thing about eggs is they are nutrient-dense with minerals, folate, B vitamins, fat-soluble vitamins, and a rich source of bioactive compounds that appear to have a positive benefit. There is no direct consumption, although there is no direct evidence that egg consumption can lead to elevated cholesterol levels, the American Heart Association Dietary Guidelines revision in 2000 recommended the public limit their consumption to less than 300 milligrams per day of cholesterol to minimize elevations in their blood of cholesterol. Interestingly, the more recent dietary guidelines for the Americans in 2015 through 2020 no longer prohibits limitations on egg intake, but recommends egg intake as a part of healthy eating patterns. So the eggs get a reprieve. Just the summary is consumption of more than one egg per day was not associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. Consumption of more than one egg per day was associated with reduction in the risk of coronary artery disease. And consumption of more than one egg per day was not associated with an increase in stroke. So far, Saturday breakfast looks okay. Additionally, there was some news on coffee. According to the Molecular Biology publication, April 20th, drinking coffee on a regular basis appears to enhance concentration and improve motor control and alertness by creating changes in the brain. The study indicated there was an improved ability to focus with coffee. So this was published in Molecular Psychiatry, but there's always going to be a kickback. And Dr. Langer from Copenhagen, Denmark, remarks, quote, also shows a possible link between habitual coffee consumption and higher stress and anxiety levels. So it looks so far that we have eggs are in, coffee's in, we can't help the bacon, that hasn't come around the corner yet. We do want to point out that Dr. Gary Shiner is going to be our guest next week. Dr. Shiner just published a significant publication about the diabetic literature. He is an international consultant, and he will be here next week, Gary Shiner. We're very happy about that. Now, today we have Dr. Matt Olivo. He comes from a long family history of Olivo physicians. They've been in South Jersey for over 70 years. Dr. Olivo initially trained at the University of Penn in bioengineering, bio-something or other. He then decided after a taste of medicine that he was going to become a doctor, and he's one of the best dermatologists in the South Jersey area. His staff has a special interest in cutaneous manifestations of systemic disease, as well as treatment of skin cancer with Mohs micrographic surgery. He has a proficiency in performing cosmetic pictures, and you should take a look at his facial paintings in his office, and is the accomplished painter whose displays are seen all over. Dr. Olivo has got a background in internal medicine. There's one thing about the Olivos, they have education suprema. And Matt, we want to say thanks for coming on Inside Medicine. Matt, are you there?
Yes, I am. Well, first
fantastic.
Of all,
fantastic.
Okay, and it sounds good, right?
It sounds good.
Okay, So first of all, I wanted to thank you for your generous introduction, and I also wanted to take an opportunity to thank my amazing colleague, Dr. Joe Fallon, and the staff at WWDB for the opportunity to educate the public on various topics relevant to dermatology. And also I want to acknowledge the contributions of people who made it possible for me to practice and service the community whose our practice goes back, as Joe said, over 7 decades. These would include my father and mentor, Matthew Anthony Olivo, MD, a fellow of the American Academy of Dermatology, and my mother, Amelia Olivo, his office manager of 40 years, both of which are deceased, my lovely wife, Rosemary Olivo, who has patiently overseen office operations for 30 years, Nathan, a counselor, a superb physician's assistant, as well as my many compassionate and caring staff members. Without these fine people, I would not be able to have the opportunity to continue the practice of dermatology at a high level. Okay.
So, Matt, let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
Why is it important to be treated by a board-certified dermatologist? And why are board-certified dermatologists the experts in the diseases of hair, skin, and nails, a triple threat?
All right. Well, the training of a dermatologist is unique compared with other other specialties within medicine. And to become a board-certified dermatologist, you obviously have to have your 4 years of college. You need your 4 years of medical school training. You need to get into a residency program. You have to do at least one base year of internal medicine or surgery, family practice, etc. In my case, I did 3 years of internal medicine and practiced internal medicine, then went back and did derm. And then dermatology is its own residency because dermatologists speak in a different language. They approach the practice of dermatology differently than other specialists, and our whole training, I trained at Hahnemann, unfortunately. They closed that program, which is actually quite tragic, but I had great mentors, and the whole purpose of the three-year residency is more and more exposure to all aspects of dermatology. You asked about why are they the experts in nail and in skin mucosal membranes. It's because first of all, it's proficiency. You see a lot of these diseases, the nails, the hair, the sweat glands, even pain are topics that are constantly taught about itching. And in my opinion, dermatologists are the itching experts. And itching is underappreciated. We talk about pain, and then there are a number of great pain physicians. It is its own specialty, but when you talk about itching, it's the dermatologist because you're constantly people are scratching at things. Why are they scratching? Because they itch, or is it stress? So it's a excellent 3-year residency devoted to nothing essentially but the skin and the hair and the nails. And also dermatologists continue their education for their lifetime while they're in the practice with the American Academy of Dermatology.
Matt.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so let's just go on to something that's got a lot of people upset, and that's skin cancers. What are the various types of skin cancers? It's not one. I'm sure they cause itch. And can tanning, with the summer coming up, does that cause skin cancer?
Okay, well, your three major types of skin cancer are, in terms of frequency, is basal cell carcinoma is the most common type of skin cancer. And it currently, in the United States, one out of every 4 Caucasians will get basal cell skin cancer in their lifetime. And then the second most common is squamous cell skin cancer, more commonly seen as people get older. So it's a little bit more common in an older age group. By that I mean 70s, 80s, 90s, beyond. And then you have malignant melanoma, which is the most common, that's the third most common, but it's the most common of the lethal skin cancers. And unfortunately, ultraviolet, which means tanning parlors, excessive sun exposure, that your ultraviolet makes all three of these types of skin cancers much more likely. So there really is nothing, and the American Academy of Dermatology stresses this, there is no such thing as a healthy tan, because that means that your body's already responding to an insult, and it's, you know, it has to, you have to be prudent about exposure.
Got it. So how do you address these cancers? Because I think Cal's got a question for you.
Okay. What is Mohs surgery?
Okay, Mohs surgery.
What is Mohs surgery?
Yeah, Mohs, and it's actually M-O-H-S. Mohs surgery is actually a form of surgery that was named in honor of Dr. Frederick Mohs. And Frederick Mohs actually wasn't a dermatologist. He was a general surgeon, and he came up with this concept actually while he was a medical student in the 1930s. And he ended up teaching primarily dermatologists about his technique. And this is a real-time, it's an acronym also. It stands for microscopic oriented histologic surgery. So as opposed to you having a biopsy, and then you have it sent away, and it may take anywhere from several days to a couple weeks to get the report. This is real-time identification of the tumor, and in addition to that, you get to see what the extent of the tumor is. Where is it? Which way is it going? Is it going left, right? Is it going deep? And you have to have a special facility. Our office has its own Mohs laboratory, so when I cut the tissue out of the patient, obviously they're under local, I give it to my staff. They create, they freeze it, they slice it, they stain it, and then it's up to me to look at these slides while the patient is still in my office, and I can identify where the tumor is if it's left.
Let me just stop in a second here.
Yes, sir.
So wait a minute. Everybody's got to get a picture because not everybody's a dermatologist or a physician. So what you're saying is that you have a mass or a skin mass,
mm-hmm.
and you have to decide where the margins are or how deep it is. So you're not taking a big biopsy plug. What exactly are you doing?
Okay, so we usually know what type of tumor it is in advance because we've already biopsied it and sent it to one of my colleagues who is are really amazing at their ability to identify common and also rare tumor types. We get that report, and then we schedule the patient for the surgery. So we numb them up under a local, and they basically, I'm basically creating a little saucer of tissue that I'm going to put, have my staff create a glass slide for. And it's under local, and then based on where it's located, the tumor is located, is it on the sides, is it underneath? Or is it both? We're going to plan our next immediate, you could say, I use it when I'm telling the patients, it's like the old style ceramic bowls. You have a little bowl, and then there's a bigger bowl, and then there's a bigger bowl. Okay, so essentially we're going through different size bowls to go all the way around. I know we're on radio, obviously, and I'm using my hands, and nobody can see that. But I'm going for progressively larger areas, and depending upon in what direction the tumor goes, I may have the option to spare tissue. So what's beautiful about Mohs, it's not only immediate, but it spares tissue, and it allows for the proper reconstruction. If we do what's traditionally done in a lot of situations for basal cell carcinomas, dermatologists will burn and scrape. Well, that doesn't allow really for closure of the wounds effectively at the time of surgery. More than occasionally, we close our own wounds right there at the time when we've complete the tumor removal. Then we can close the wounds, and that allows for less risk of bleeding and possibly a better cosmetic result.
Okay, so but just the concept is what you're doing is you're taking very thin slices.
Correct.
So that you don't take too much and you don't take too little, so that you can decide if you have to go again and again and again. So in other words, the thing about Mohs is when you show up, you don't get out of there in 5 minutes.
No, no, I like to tell patients it's just like a day procedure. You go to the surgery center. You're not in and out of a surgery center or a hospital in 2 minutes. It's a long process. Hopefully done within several hours or a day. Depends on the size of the tumor. When we're cutting these tumors out, we're basically using only a couple millimeters of tissue all the way around, so it's thin. And on certain areas like the fingers, the genitals, the ears, the nose, the lip, the eyelid, you want to be as tissue sparing as possible because that means less scarring, which is functionally debilitating. It's emotionally debilitating, and unfortunately, some of the patients when they come in, they are not aware that they have large tumors, which is tragic. And then some people just unfortunately are in denial. They have skin cancer.
But sometimes even this physician doesn't know how deep it's going to be. I assume that's a case that you run into at times because some people think they're going to be there 2 hours and they may be there 4 hours.
That would be correct because you have certain tumors, even basal cells that are supposed to be less aggressive, you have subvariants of basal cells. That's why it's important to get a proper reading of what tumor type and what subtype that is. So you have more aggressive variants. Ones are called morpheiforms, and others are infiltrating. Other are also known as micronodular. So essentially they could be the classic iceberg. You see something small, and then when you start cutting, it continues deep and around. And some of these are huge. You don't always know that, but that's the other beautiful thing about when I do the biopsies and I send them to a board certified dermatopathologist to read, I'm expecting them to give me the most accurate, you could say, scouting report, so I know how to approach the enemy or
So there's multiple slices usually to make sure you don't take too much because you want people to heal up and look great, but you have to get the entire mass, so you keep slicing slightly. So it's tough on the patient's nerves, and they've got to just be able to sit tight because you're trying to do the least amount of surgery as possible, but to get every single cell out. So basically, people have to know Mohs surgery. The guy was actually a brilliant person to suggest doing this because you don't take a big clump. And it's resulted in the technology with somebody looking at the tumor. It shows that good teamwork can get the patients better results, but complete results, and on their way.
Yeah, clearly, as you said, Joe, it's when we do Mohs on selected days. It's a team effort. So I have great laboratory staff, and they are meticulous, and we're dealing with something like on the side of the nose. I don't want this to go yet be too big. It's all tissue sparing. That's just really important. It helps us do the reconstruction more easily. We also want to make sure that we have what we call negative margins, so that we've taken out all the tumor that's visible.
The take home point: great surgery, great results, but it can take time. Because it's just they're trying to take the minimal amount of tissue out so the skin heals up and everybody continues to look great.
That's correct.
Okay, so let's just move on a little bit because dermatology does more than these complicated Mohs procedures that get great results. What about hair loss? Everybody's complaining about that, at least in my practice. So what about that for a dermatologist? I'm sure that's something that you love to hear about.
Hair is so essential to self-esteem for guys, yes, but even more so for women. And essentially, there are two major classifications of hair loss. The hair loss that is scarring, and then hair loss that is not scarring. A perfect example of hair loss that is not scarring is what we call telogen effluvium. Now, any woman who's been pregnant after she gives birth, 3 months after the period of the birth, then she starts shedding hair. The beautiful thing about that individual is I can reassure him. I said, look, your hair's going to come back because you still have the roots. So essentially it's like, bushes or trees. If you have roots, the tree comes back. If you don't have roots, it's much harder. Now, we have destructive forms of hair loss, and those result in scarring. Perfect example is you can have patients that have lupus, and lupus can be a very highly destructive process where it's an autoimmune, and it destroys the hair follicles. There's another condition called lichen planopilaris, and there are various versions of that, and that's also destructive. And that you have to intervene as soon as possible with various types of treatments, pills, topicals. Sometimes we give the patients shots right into those areas because we're trying to decrease the inflammation. And if you decrease the inflammation, you save them a lot of pain and sorrow.
Got it. So I remember my father talking about in World War II, where he was stationed in Europe, and the Germans, I don't know, they had some kind of buzz bombs or something, and that a lot of people actually had an effluvium after the bombs were dropped. They would lose their hair. So it's interesting what stress can do. And additionally, I remember that some patients, when they get a telogen effusion, are just totally upset. We had an individual years ago who had an afro, and he had surgery on his thyroid, which resulted in a significant drop in levels, and all of a sudden his afro fell out, and the guy was almost, extremely distraught. But the nice thing about that is if you can tell them that the roots are still there, they're going to get better. At least it resolves that issue. So a telogen effusion sounds drastic, but the good news, the roots are usually still there. Is that a correct summation?
Yes, that would be correct. And the thing is, that's with proper examination. So when I'm examining a patient, and this was stressed actually by my father, because I was fortunate enough to moonlight with him. I needed to continue paying my mortgage, so I had to moonlight with my father on weekends and holidays and the like. But he taught me a lot of practical tips, and one of which is you have to make sure you touch the patient. A little harder in these times of COVID, but that still hasn't stopped us to do that, because you have to be able to palpate the skin. You have to be able to look at the skin. You need proper lighting. You need proper, I have my visor on, because you need magnification. So you need magnification, lighting. You need to spend time looking at the patient. So I'm pretty vehement about that. You cannot make some of these diagnoses in 30 seconds. Sometimes you can, but, you know.
Okay. So we got a – Matt's got a – Cal's got a question for you, Matt.
Yes.
What can affect the skin?
Well, that's a little bit broad. He wanted to know, can stress affect the skin?
Oh, most definitely. A perfect example of how stress can affect the skin is well, let's talk about stress. Right now, we have an epidemic. The pandemic is, and within that pandemic, we have a stress pandemic. You know, there's literally so much stress. So that in itself can cause hair loss. I have patients that are scratching, picking. Their heart is actually on their sleeves, from the standpoint of they're scratching and picking at themselves because of stress. So you can pick at the skin. Those picked areas are called picker's nodules, or the medical term for is prurigo nodularis. So unfortunately, you have some people that end up picking at their skin, and that has to be treated. So that's a stress effect. Also, stress can affect. You can have rosacea, acne, a number of our psoriasis can get worse with stress. And I'm actually seeing a lot of this, and just because the environment is more stressful right now, because people are fearful, they're scared, and it is tragic. In addition to topicals, I sometimes prescribe non-sedating antihistamines, sometimes sedating antihistamines because they're not getting enough sleep. And that's going to be helpful for them to, get in the evening. I also believe in prescribing certain non-addictive, non-sedating medications such as buspirone. I'm a big fan of that. It's been around since the mid-80s. It's not addictive. So we have and that's probably because my training as an internist, you have to treat the whole patient and not merely the skin like they were dropping off clothing at a dry cleaner.
So one thing what you're saying here, Matt, is that there's a lot of people, even while they're sleeping, are picking.
Oh, yes.
And that for a lot of people, it must be something that they just can't control. And you're saying that if you give them certain medications, that can decrease their picking, which will allow the wounds to heal quicker.
That's correct. That and sometimes just bring it to their attention, gently bringing it to their attention. Now, you know, then we have this discussion sometimes. So if I know that it's clearly something that they're picking at, also the question I will often ask, Nathan does too, is there blood on your sheets? Okay, so some people are not aware that they're scratching. So sometimes you have to ask that, just like you do, Joe, you have to ask that additional question, you know, and that helps sometimes, and sometimes you have to ask the question multiple times, or, you know, my staff will come in, ask a question, physician, you know, the physician's assistant will come in, Nathan will come in and ask the question, and guess what? By the time they get peppered by my question, oh, by the way, you're right, Doc, I have this. So sometimes it's asking a question again and again and again. And that gets
one of the tricks I think for this business is trying to get the healthiest skin possible. So if you see somebody with multiple, you know, papules or something, you know, that they've scratched off, like the scratchers, is there something that you do to recommend to try and enhance skin function? Because I think there's a pH issue with skin.
Well, I'm a big fan. My father's extra generation of dermatologists, there was a concept, it's still valid, called the acid mantle barrier. So when certain patients are infected, or I'll give you, for instance, somebody gets poison ivy and it blisters, one thing that is simple, holistic, we actually do a water and vinegar soak. The water and vinegar soak is a lot of water and very little vinegar, but it helps increase it actually decreases the pH. It makes them a little less susceptible in, like, blistering conditions. It dries it out. They're less susceptible to infection that way. So that's a simple, almost homeopathic, practical, low-cost approach to certain skin conditions. Not all, but certain.
So in other words, so you're saying that you use a low amount of vinegar, and
mm-hmm.
then you use a large amount of water, and because the skin likes to be acidic, that acidifies the skin, which improves the skin's health and makes it more resistant to those scratchers and whatever.
Well,
did I sum that up correctly?
Well, not necessarily the scratching. Not necessarily the scratching. If somebody has a blistering condition, I use it for the drying out of blistering. If something's grossly infected, we help it. If somebody has an infection, sometimes we use a water vinegar soak for that reason. Just for the reasons of itching, which we call pruritus, I don't find it necessarily quite as effective. Now, something that is old school that goes back to my father's generation is the use of menthol. There's a product out there called Sarna Lotion, and Sarna Lotion is kind of fascinating because the original formula has menthol in it. Menthol is soothing and cooling. So for some people who are very itchy, using that cooling sensation helps. It distracts. It keeps them from wanting to scratch. So that's a practical, low-cost way of approaching the problem. There are also anti-itching agents called Promoxine, which is also available over the counter, and that helps itching too. And then sometimes you have to look at itching in its more global fashion. Sometimes you have patients basically Hodgkin's lymphoma. As you and I both know, it can present as itching. So sometimes the itching is of a systemic cause. Perfect example would be people who have early renal failure, kidney failure. They can start experiencing itching, insomnia, and they can also have, anorexia. And so in that case, you have to check blood work. As you know,
right.
You know, thyroid issues can be, you know, experienced. They can experience that. There are other internal conditions, liver disease,
sure.
Hepatitis. They can all be. So sometimes when I'm seeing somebody who's scratching with, but and experiencing a lot of itching, but no real primary lesions, I have to start wondering what's going on internally. Now, obviously, you have the patients that have mite called scabies, and then you usually get from the history, oh, it's worse at night. And, you know, I was just recently in a nursing home, or I visited my parents in a nursing home, and now my family is itching. Then you have to look for the evidence of the mite infection. So itching in itself is an amazing topic to talk about.
So the differential diagnosis is extensive, and that's why you need to go to somebody who can quickly go through the differential and come up with an answer. What was the name of that S-menthol product you mentioned?
Yeah, it's called Sarna, S-A-R-N-A. And I'm not sure, I don't remember which company makes it, but, you know, also there's generic forms of it, but you want not the one generally for sensitive skin. I tell patients, you know, jokingly, I said, well, you know, some people use it as a perfume to enhance mating, so just be careful. But the menthol, some people like it, some people don't in terms of the smell, but most people are greatly appreciative that you're helping them with the itching and not sedating them. So this is something you can use during the day.
Got it. So here we're going to take a break here. 1 second. Dr. Petronzio is on from North Jersey, hanging out at the Urgent Center. George, what do you have to say? I know you're the COVID expert east of the Mississippi.
Yep. Thank you, Joe, for those kind words. Reporting from Hackensack Meridian up here in North Jersey. And with Jeffrey Welsh, my administrator, we're having a go of it. We're still having a lot of people coming in with the positive PCR tests and rapids. What we're seeing is the people that come in with the rapid, we're directing them over for the IV monoclonal antibodies if they meet criteria. Moving forward, the latest, as you know, they've shut down travel from India with the problem of India and their tragedies over there. The second issue is that the Brazilian strain, the P1 variant, is already here. There's roughly 486 documented in 38 states already, I believe, or 36 in the country. Now, the concern about the variant from Brazil is a major one because of the fact that the Brazilian variant is able to circumvent most of the vaccines that are there until they are fortified and upgraded, where Moderna and Pfizer are trying to get an upgraded for the Brazilian variant for immunity. The problem with the P1 or the Brazilian strain is the fact that it can circumvent three of the medicines we use for monoclonal antibodies of the four that are available. So that is challenging because of the fact that if the P1 Brazilian variant takes hold, it is a problem. So I can, word of caution, I would probably avoid the travel to areas, i.e. To Brazil, so that you don't contract it or, you know, bring that home per se. I think it would be responsible. I don't know where it stands with the U.S. government if they're going to shut down the travel from Brazil. I don't think it'll be the entire South America, but the problem is people travel all around from Brazil to other South American countries. So that's the most
George,
challenging one.
So, George, is the P variant in New Jersey, and is it in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia?
Yes. I can't.
It is there?
It is in New Jersey, and it is in Pennsylvania, yes. I don't know about specifically Philadelphia, but I might assume because of the population, it's probably there.
Okay.
People who are Brazilian in New Jersey, here in Long Branch, per se, they're requesting that their relatives do not come and visit them to prevent them from bringing the P1 variant here, which I think is a very wise move from that standpoint. The people are very nice from Brazil, but at the same token, they don't want to have relatives coming up here and causing the P1
sure.
variant to spread. All right.
George, final word. Final word.
Continue to use caution. Try to use your mask as much as possible. If you're able to obtain the Tafix, T-A-F-F-I-X, nasal spray, if you're going to travel, train, plane, sea travel, this is a nasal spray that lasts for 5 hours. It It acidifies the mucous membranes and prevents the transfer of any of the viruses in the nasal passage. So if you're able to obtain that on the internet, it's from Israel. It does work. It lasts for 5 hours, and then you can respray. So anybody going on extended flights, when you take your mask off, if you're eating in a public area or on a plane, train, et cetera, I would recommend if you can obtain the Tafix, T-A-F-F-I-X, nasal spray. We had several calls on that from a prior show. And this
George.
Is George Petruncio reporting from Hackensack Meridian.
As always,
and
thank you, Sir George.
All right. And my private office is in Turnersville, New Jersey, 856-875-7700. All right. I can answer questions.
Thank you, George.
All right. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, Matt.
Yes, sir.
Lupus, systemic lupus erythematosus, does that affect the skin?
Oh, most certainly. Actually, no organ is exempt from lupus. And in terms of lupus, you know, everybody thinks of, or some of our colleagues think of, the butterfly rash, but that's not the only thing. There's something called, well, first of all, we talk about lupus. You can have systemic lupus without skin findings. You can have lupus only confined to the skin without any systemic findings. So you can have, and then there's that interplay between the skin and also the you know, more systemic. You have discoid lupus, which is a scarring form of lupus, and you get follicular plugging. You get basically destruction, like if it occurs in the scalp, you can destruction of the hair follicles. So again, going back to a prior discussion we had, this is a scarring version of hair loss. You can also get lupus can cause a reversible hair loss. These are usually sun sensitive, so many patients get worse with sun exposure. Another reason to be careful about sun exposure, especially if you know that you have lupus.
Well, okay, so that I didn't even know all this, so we thank you for that update. I just have a few questions. I just want to move on. Do dermatologists look in the mouth?
Most certainly. It, you know, certain here, perfect example. We were talking about the mouth, and let's go back to hair loss. Okay, there is a scarring hair loss called lichen planopilaris. It can also present as lichen planus of the mouth. It's a white lacy condition that you see in the mouth, and it causes irritation. And in certain cases, if it's pronounced and it's prolonged, it can predispose to oral skin cancer. You know, dermatologists are also experts at the mucosal membranes, so that we're looking at, we're looking in the mouth, also the lips. You have what's called leukoplakia, that's whitening of the lips, that's not related to Candida, which is a yeast. Have to be careful of those kind of conditions because those are precancerous. So leukoplakia, erythroplakia, so redness of the lips, you know, and leukoplakia is whiteness of the lips. You can also see leukoplakia in the mouth, and that's precancerous. Leukoplakia is more common when you have patients, especially men, who smoke and drink. And I'm talking about hard liquor, not just, you know, your occasional beer, a glass of beer or a glass of wine. And that should be biopsied if there's any question, because you can detect early oral skin cancer, which is also an indication for Mohs, because that, again, that's tissue sparing.
Got it. So usually when people think of thyroid disease, we think of dry skin. What does the dermatologist think of thyroid? Do they see a lateral loss of the lateral third of the eyebrows? How do dermatologists key on to diagnosing underlying thyroid disease?
Well, it's not just looking at the skin. It's also looking at the patient. Obviously, if their eyes are bulging out, we're looking at an autoimmune thyroid condition. Also, when you have somebody who has hypothyroidism, their hair is going to be slow to grow. It's going to be coarse. It's going to be dry. Their skin's going to be coarse and dry also. You, as you mentioned, you're going to notice a loss of the lateral third of the eyebrows, They sweat less, and then usually their skin is less greasy too.
Gotcha. So so the question is that who sends endocrinologists more business, dermatologists or hairdressers? Just interested in your guess.
My guess would be hairdressers, I would guess. But I don't know that.
Yeah.
I know who the best endocrinologist is in our area, and I'm talking to him. So,
okay. So I can tell you this: that when I left, the professor said to me, "Fallon, if you want to be a success, be nice to all hairdressers because they're going to send you so much thyroid business." So, I just want to give a shout out to the hairdressers. Thank you very much. So, how about if the patient comes in and says, and I know you've got pictures that you've painted in your paintings in your office that you've done. I just feel tired and aged. Are there any products that are safe and available that I could use to make me more youthful? I'm sure that's something that you get, and you probably have something up your sleeve to help them.
Well, I don't overhype any procedure or any product. That's number one, because the thing is, We have to be, you know, I currently I don't have the magic wand to reverse, you know, 60 years of age related sun damage or just aging of the skin. You know, it's a fact, and that I want to make sure that people understand that. That being said, we are very fortunate because, you know, the retinoids, specifically Retin A, which most people know about. A lot of that research came from the University of Pennsylvania, one of my father's colleagues, Dr. Albert Kligman. And back in 1985, he, in the midst of treating people with acne, he noticed that it reversed sun damage. It reversed wrinkling. It made people more youthful. So we're fortunate in that respect that a lot of the research comes right from Philadelphia. Again, we are very fortunate because Dr. Eugene Van Scott, who was originally from Temple University, he's pretty much considered the father or grandfather of the alpha hydroxy acid movement. And he was from Temple, and he was an extraordinary individual because he was a clinician first and foremost. And he made these observations. And I remember when Temple closed their program and we were fortunate enough to get him, he was an incredible individual. So there are topicals we can use. Also, dermatologists were at the forefront of the use of Botox, which properly used, again, like everything else, which properly used, can make people look rested, not plastic. You know, it's understanding the nuances of aesthetic medicine. And not everybody understands that. Also, fillers, properly used. We have some really safe fillers. When I was finishing my residency, you had to be careful about the use of collagen because some people didn't tolerate it, were allergic to it. You had to do skin testing. For the most part, the products like Restylane, which is hyaluronic acid, are usually very well tolerated when they're put in the right location. And that's both an aesthetic issue, but also a medical issue, because you have to be careful about the injection of these products, because, you know, the unexperienced individuals who are using fillers, there have been cases where they've injected them into blood vessels, especially in the area between the eyebrow, which is called the glabella. There have been some cases where they injected right into a major vessel, and they cause temporary or permanent blindness. So they're not totally benign. And so people have to understand, people who use these actually have to be, you know, quite adept and understand the anatomy. And unfortunately, that's not the case with everybody who all of a sudden took a course.
Gotcha. So just moving on, skin changes during pregnancy. You know, the old saying was that if you're having a girl, that it takes the beauty away from the mother. I don't know if that's true, but I'm just curious, as a dermatologist, what do you see during pregnancies?
Well, I've actually seen some women that, because they emotionally or psychologically embrace the pregnancy, they get red rosy cheeks, they look happy, their face fills out, they literally look just so, they look like they're enjoying themselves. And in fact, I've had a couple of women who said this is the best thing that I've ever had. That being said, from a strictly medical standpoint, when estrogen levels get higher, you will sometimes see something called melasma, also known as the mask of pregnancy. Now, women do not have to have pregnancy to get melasma. Birth control pills do it. Estrogen supplements do it. In some cases, large amounts of soy protein can also cause a discoloration. It's a hyperpigmentation, a deepening of the skin tones, usually on the center of the face, sometimes the forehead and chin. So that would be like one cause. There are other pregnancy-related issues. There's something that's called, and my chief used to call it. My chief was a fantastic guy at Hahnemann, Dr. Spielvogel. He used to call it PUPPY, and it really is an acronym. It stands for Pruritic and Urticarial Papules and Plaques of Pregnancy. Obviously, that's why they call it PUPPY. And that actually is a papular condition, and usually in the last trimester, and it can be very itchy, but it's, for the most part, pretty benign and resolves soon after the birth of the child. That is in contradistinction to a blistering condition called herpes gestationis. Actually a very bad name, because it has nothing to do with the herpes virus. It just is a blistering virus. It's actually akin to another disease that dermatologists commonly seen, which is known as bullous pemphigoid. So they're very similar to one another. That is a little more dangerous, very rare. I've seen one case in 30 years. Its frequency is about 1 out of 50,000 pregnancies, so it's rare, but it has potential to be distressing and potentially affect the mother, less so the child.
Got it. So obviously pregnancy can mean a little bit of a differential diagnosis. That's what it sounds like to me.
Mm-hmm.
Just moving on, what the heck is psoriasis? We see advertisements on the TV, treat your psoriasis, we'll get rid of it. And can you treat psoriasis on the skin and help arthritis? So it's a double-edged question.
Yeah. Okay, so when I was a resident, there was some thought that it was an inflammatory condition. Now we know with greater certainty now that it's the immune system is on overdrive, and that overdrive also affects types of arthritis called psoriatic arthritis. Oftentimes you will see patients with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, but sometimes you have to ask the patients, are you having problems with your joints? You have to look at their joints. So it's more than just looking at the skin. In terms of treatment, if you're talking about basic treatments, because they think 2 to 3% of the population has actually psoriasis, many of which never seek treatment because it's relatively mild. But, cortisones, moisturizers, antihistamines, oral antihistamines. Sometimes the itching is significant. You can also inject these with bits of cortisone carefully. You can give them cortisone orally. I try to stay away from that. As you can appreciate, some of my patients are diabetic, and I'm not going to, throw their diabetes out of control. We have other more systemic agents, methotrexate, which is a chemotherapy agent. We have escitalopram. Escitalopram is basically a sister drug to Accutane. So it's a synthetic vitamin A. Those came out first. Then you have the biological agents, of which there are a plethora of them, and they are anti-inflammatory. You have to use them prudently because they're more systemic. They do have certain risks, increased infection, and also increased risk of potentially of malignancy. So there's a whole now basically there's a whole menu that we didn't have, 15, 20 years ago.
So what you're saying is that these agents are potent, and due to their potency, they can have a lot of pluses, but you have to watch out you don't have any negatives.
You can get a really sharp, good shave with a scimitar, but you can also get cut. So there's my analogy.
Okay. So what exactly does psoriasis look at? If somebody's over there on the radio, how would you describe? Patient walks in and says, "What is this skin thing?" But what would they look like for just a general psoriasis diagnosis?
Okay, so red patches that are often scaly. Silver, classically they call it a silvery scale. So silvery scale, sometimes very thick, usually in areas of common trauma, so elbows, tops of hands, knees, you know, backside, usually near the belt, sometimes behind the ears, into the scalp. It also can affect the nails. So we were just talking about, you know, nails. Dermatologists are nail experts, so various you can get nail involvement, which gets misdiagnosed as fungal involvement of the nails. That could be psoriatic. One of the conditions we talked about that affects the mouth, lichen planus, can also affect the nails. So, you know, it's everything, actually.
Right. So magic can occur, but you need somebody to pick the right drug for the right reason. And again, then the patient will benefit supremely.
And minimize risk, which
amen.
I know.
Sorry about that. So there is something called shingles, and my wife is threatening me to get a shingles vaccine. I've been a little bit hesitant, so I'm even a patient myself. So can you tell us about shingles, which is incredibly painful, and if I get it, she's going to tell me that she's right. So tell me about shingles, because derm's in that.
Okay, so I consider, you know, and that's a little biased perspective, that dermatologists are the best experts in treating shingles. Shingles is a reactivation of the chickenpox virus, and the vast majority of us in the Delaware Valley have been exposed to chickenpox in our lifetime. We're talking especially those people, let's say, over age 40, because there was no chickenpox vaccine. So it's a reactivation. It's usually unilateral, runs along what we call a dermatome. So essentially this is a nerve tract that goes from the center of the spine or the center of the brain in one direction around. It's sometimes itchy, but oftentimes painful, can be groups of blisters with red on top of red patches. And if not treated, can result in short-term pain or even chronic pain. And that's why it's important to have quick early identification, proper treatment. If people aren't sulfa allergic, in addition to using the medications called acyclovir, but the newer ones are famciclovir and valcyclovir, so that's that second generation, they're very effective. And we usually treat them for 7 days. In older patients, I have to check their, you know, I personally prefer to check their kidney function because they are cleared by the kidney.
Got it.
Also topicals. They need pain medication oftentimes on a short-term basis. Water and vinegar soaks, we had mentioned that I love using it because it's a blistering condition. You acidify the skin, you decrease secondary infection.
What is the RX for that? How do you tell them to mix and apply?
Well, if you have a blistering condition, I like simple things that are simple and straightforward. White vinegar, 1 ounce of white vinegar to 1 quart of lukewarm water. So roughly 1 to 32. It doesn't have to be precise, but it's not like a 1-to-1 ratio. So it's like roughly 1 ounce to 1 quart. Cool water, soaking it 2 to 3 times daily with clean, basically clean cloth or gauze, you know, clean gauze that can be disposed.
So just moving on a second, dermatology, I mean, some kids come with severe acne.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just go over how you address acne? Because that's a common condition, and luckily I don't have it anymore. But what do you do this time in this age of 2021 for acne?
Well, just like the psoriasis issue, it's based on primarily what am I seeing on the patient? Do they have only a couple pimples? Obviously, we're not going to put them on Accutane, okay? That's ludicrous. Sometimes we have to lower the expectations of the patients a little bit, so that's important. So we have topicals. We mentioned, you know, the Retin-A family. That's a synthetic topical vitamin A, so you have so that's helpful because it works on a lot of the topical aspects. We also, use certain antibiotics. The most commonly used ones are in the tetracycline class. That would be minocycline. That's one of my preferred ones. Then you also have benzoyl peroxide, which is an antibacterial, and then also topical antibiotics, and that's helpful. We also tell the patients don't pick. We try to educate them as to if the gals wear makeup, and especially if they're young gals, we want them to use makeup that's intended, that's non-comedogenic, that doesn't cause blackheads. They're not supposed to use makeup that's heavier. Sometimes we see kids that break out because they do, theater, and the theater makeups are heavier. So we have to make sure they clean their face effectively. But they don't have to. They don't have to go crazy scrubbing.
So, Dr. Olivo, we are coming to the end. Can you please tell us about your associate? Can you tell us about your practice, website, and how to get in touch with you?
Okay. Let's see. Okay. Well, in our last couple of minutes,
We have about 60 seconds.
60 seconds. Okay, we can do this in 60 seconds. Our office is located in Haddon Township at 201 Haddon Avenue on the corner of Center Street and Haddon Avenue, one block from the municipal building. Our phone number is 856-854-0300, and our website is AdvoCare, Olivo Dermatology Center. I also wish to strongly implore the public in this great Delaware Valley to please use their get their COVID vaccines and continue using the masks. Use sunscreens with a sun protective factor of at least 30 and practice smart sun avoidance and take care of your skin. And I just want to wish, I want to thank you, Joe, as well as the folks at WWDB for this opportunity to educate the public.
Matt, you did a great job. Give us that phone number again, please.
The phone number for our office is 856-854-0300.
Inside Medicine will be back next week. Dr. Matthew Olivo, we thank you. Listen to that podcast, www.wwdbam.com. Listen to Matt Inside Medicine. See you guys next week. Thank you much.
Thank you, Joe.